Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And that is Solomon Burke, None of Us Are Free, from his album Don't Give Up On Me. And I thought that was actually a really important song to open the show up with today, because we're doing a special show on the question of abortion, abortion rights, and the battle around that, and how it's coming up today, how it's focused today. And this is one of the most critical battles in the world today, I think, in terms of, if you're thinking in terms of the emancipation of all humanity, if you're thinking in terms of, you know, standing up against the oppression of everyone, but recognizing that none of us are free long as one of us is chained, makes a lot of sense in relation to this. At the back end of the show, we're going to feature an excerpt from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. This excerpt is from the DVD of a talk he gave called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And the title of the excerpt is Change for Women in a New Society. Before that, we'll be talking with Lindsay Horvath, a West Hollywood City Council member and a former president of Hollywood Now, about the state of abortion rights in America today. And we're also going to talk to Wendy Norris, a contributing writer to rhrealitycheck.org, on the attacks on the Nebraska abortion doctor Leroy Carhart, but especially how this whole focus, the cutting edge, if you will, or the blunt end of the club, is actually being brought down in Nebraska and against Dr. Carhart. And opening up the show, we are going to be talking with Sansara Taylor. Sansara has been a guest on the show many times and always provocative and always leaves you with a lot of deep things to think about and chew on. She's a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and she's also on the national board of World Can't Wait. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Michael. I'm glad to be with you.
One of the things that really led me to feel driven to do this show was the beginning of this week. I read a column from Tim Rutten in the Los Angeles Times where he was talking about the health care bill. In the very first paragraph, he says, the key thing that seems to have emerged here is that the major battleground, the sharpest battleground that not only will have repercussions for the health care bill, but for the entire society, is going to be focused up around abortion. And he was specifically talking about the Stupak-Pitts Amendment. And also at that time, they had not yet in the Senate sort of made their dropping the amendment that they had there. But he was saying that no matter what happened in the Senate, that right now with the passage of the Stupak-Pitts Amendment or the acceptance of that, that indicates how bad the terms are going to be in relation to the struggle for abortion rights. Can you speak to that?
Well, I think that's a very important observation. I think so often when it comes to the battle for women's fundamental right to abortion, which really is the right for women to control their own bodies, to control their lives and their destinies, to decide for themselves when and whether they will bear children. So often the debate gets restricted to the latest attack and sort of a rear guard debate and fight over whether there'll be further restrictions or whether the status quo will be maintained. And often people don't pull back the lens and say, look, at this point, Stupak-Pitts, the amendment which was made part of the health care reform that was passed through the House, this would have massively restricted women's access to abortion. millions of women who currently have abortion coverage as a part of their regular health care would have lost it. The fact is, a similar amendment did not make it. It was narrowly defeated in the Senate, and it's still in play what version will be in the final health care reform. But regardless of this, what it means that that was passed, that the Stupak-Pitts Amendment passed and that it was voted for by the majority of the Democrats. What that means and what that says about the political reality that turns around abortion, the both legal and extra-legal assaults on women's right to abortion, is it's a very big deal. I mean, A, it could pass in the health care overall, but even if it doesn't, what it says that this is one of the biggest assaults on women's right to abortion since Roe v. Wade. It has been met with almost no public outcry, and it's very indicative of how endangered women's right to abortion is against a landscape where also you have the most prominent and courageous, one of the most prominent and courageous abortion providers was assassinated earlier this year. And similarly, there was almost no public outcry and response.
Sansara, how did we get here? Think about this. I mean, you know, the whole point of what gave rise to the right of women to decide to have an abortion, the whole atmosphere in society, for a long time, this was so much taken for granted after the passage of Roe v. Wade. And even to a certain extent, even though there were assaults on it all along over the last few decades, suddenly you're hit with this and you recognize that there really is this dark age morality that's being imposed on people. And the question I think a lot of people have, you know, is how did we get here? How do we go from this spot to here where it's true? I mean, the most passionate people are these Christian fascists and these lunatics, these homicidal lunatics that are allied with them, arson against abortion clinics, killing abortion providers, all of these things that are going on. And yet the other side, the people in the good hats are not moving, are not out in the streets in a way commensurate with what's going on. But there seems to be a whole climate change that has shifted that is really remarkable in terms of the framework that we're talking about, where abortion is considered at best, a necessary evil.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, man, there's a lot that you raised. In a basic way, look, the majority of the people in this country do believe in the right for women to have abortion. But the political initiative and the moral high ground has been ceded over the course of the last several decades to this Christian fascist movement. And a lot of the energies of the pro-choice majority have been defused, they've been suffocated, they've been squandered, they've been channeled into dead ends. And I want to speak very specifically, the so-called leaders of the so-called pro-choice movement, and I say that very pointedly, have for years slavishly subordinated themselves to the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party itself has had a leading view, first voiced by Bill Clinton, abortion should be safe, legal, and rare, accepting the premise that there's something wrong with abortion. Hillary Clinton took that even further when she said abortion's a tragic choice. Barack Obama came out earlier this year at Notre Dame and said abortion is a heart-wrenching decision for any woman. All of this is conceding the notion that there's something morally wrong with abortion, which is not true. Abortion is not murder. Fetuses are not babies. It is a very, very positive thing for women to have the ability to decide for themselves when and whether to have children. Without that right, women have no more freedom than a slave. And that's a fundamental, we should have the moral high ground. We are not calling for the enslavement of women to their reproduction. We are not out there terrorizing clinics and killing doctors and lying and passing legislation that's going to cause women to die. I mean, the whole debate around Stupak-Pitts is, does it or does it not maintain the status quo of the Hyde Amendment, which banned federal funds for abortion? Well, the Hyde Amendment caused many women to die. This is what said that if you are low income, you can't get Medicare. You can't get Medicaid to cover abortion. This directly led to women bleeding to death from perforated uteruses, from trying to self-induce abortions. This has contributed. So the status quo has been terrible to begin with, but the whole defensive notion that there's something wrong with abortion has been something that the Democrats have taken up, and the pro-choice movement as such. And I want to be very specific, NARAL. Now, Feminist Majority Foundation, Emily's List, you name them, they have slavishly subordinated themselves and attached themselves to the Democratic Party. And rather than mobilizing people and seizing back the moral high ground and saying this is a very positive thing for women to have the right to abortion, there's nothing wrong with it, fetuses are not babies, there's science, and it's just not the case, they've channeled this majority's efforts into pleading with, frankly, these days, groveling to these Democratic politicians who are compromising away the fundamental rights of women. And meanwhile, you have a whole generation. I think it's very heavy. A lot of people are observing that the younger generation is less passionately pro-choice. And a lot of people have made the observation, look, they don't have the memories of the back alleys. They don't have the memories of what it was like when women were dying from illegal abortions. A lot of young women take this right for granted, and there's truth to that, but I think the deeper, more fundamental fact is that two generations now have grown up in a world where they are more likely to have heard a very passionate defense of the so-called rights and the so-called dignity of frozen embryos. They're more likely to have heard that than to have heard a passionate defense of the righteousness of women having the right to abortion without shame, without stigma, without coercion, without danger, and that that's a very positive thing. And when you have that, the moral high ground having been given up, and you have that shaping the culture, this is what's led to the situation we're in today.
Let me remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate, and you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show. Today we're talking with Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and a member of the National Board of the World Can't Wait organization. And we're talking about abortion, the morality of abortion, and the importance of people understanding that the right to abortion is a fundamental right that women must have. And if they don't have it, essentially, they're relegated to slavery. Sansara, I was talking with somebody the other day, and I showed them a piece you had written. And in a number of times, a number of different pieces, you come to the point where they're always talking about Obama, whether it's Obama, Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, whoever. They're always talking about this point that you just raised about, well, you know, this is sort of really, it's a sad situation. It's really women feel guilt and shame. It's such a heart-wrenching decision, and that we should just make sure that abortions are rare. It was so refreshing. And the young woman told me that yesterday when she read your piece. She said, it's so refreshing. I don't think I've ever read something that said, no, this is not what we should be demanding, is that abortion should be more rare. That should be rare. It should be a rare occurrence in society. In fact, there should be, the ground should be laid for abortion to be a matter of fact decision. You know, and it's interesting because I was talking to somebody again over the weekend about, well, how rare is it to even see a film or a television show where a woman gets pregnant, doesn't want to be pregnant, has an abortion as a matter of fact decision, and goes on. Instead, it's always something very gut-wrenching, heart-wrenching, causing all kinds of major problems in her life. Can you speak about that? I mean, have you thought about that any?
Yeah, I think on two levels. One is, the majority of women, look, a third of the women in this country have had abortions, and more will. This is one of the most common, one of the safest, one of the most simple medical procedures. Very widespread, but you never hear people talk about it. It's very stunning. It's completely outrageous. There's a cloud and a stigma that hangs over it. But the fact is that the majority of women, when they get their abortions, the biggest thing they feel is relief. Some even feel joy at having the ability to take their own destiny into their hands and determine the course of their lives. That's a very positive thing. Now, to the degree that some women feel conflicted about it, and there are women who feel conflicted about it, they feel guilty, they feel shameful, they feel many things, to the degree that that's the case, it's because there have been, again, for decades, people at the clinics, at every abortion clinic almost in the country, screaming at them, calling them, you know, you'll always be a mother, you'll just be the mother of a dead baby. No, you won't. You'll be a woman who terminated a subordinate part of your body that had the potential to be a human, but it's not yet, you know. But there's this guilt. And then in the popular media, in the movies, in the culture, all of this, like you're saying, it's always portrayed as something very traumatic. And so women internalize that. And I have to say, I've used this before, I think it's very important. The fact is, first of all, most women do not feel guilty, but to the degree that some do, that does not prove that abortion is a morally complex issue, any more than the fact that many women feel guilty, feel ashamed, feel all kinds of negative things about themselves after they were raped, means that rape is a morally complex issue. It means that this society puts stigma on women for things that actually women are victimized over, you know, that we should reject that, and we actually need people. I want people who are listening. Go tell somebody. If you've had an abortion, you have a friend who had an abortion, you think there's nothing wrong with it, go tell three people today. We need to actually change the atmosphere around this. And then the stigma that's put on abortion, I want to say it follows. I really want to make clear that the pro-choice sentiment, and even that word pro-choice, as opposed to being pro-abortion rights, it's like the word is stigmatized. The pro-choice movement has accepted this stigma to a large degree, and it's transferred to the doctors. I just have to say this. It's easy to look at a moment like this where there's this big assault on abortion rights and to say, well, look at these right-wing fascists. And we should look at them, and they are fascists. But we should also look at how we've gotten to a place where even with the majority, we keep losing ground. And I have to say that the pro-choice movement has distanced itself from the procedure of abortion. It's also distanced itself from the doctors. And earlier this year when Dr. Tiller was killed, I think it is shameful, but it's something we have to recognize, and we have to break out of this framework, that not a single national politicians showed up to his funeral. Over 1,000 people came to his funeral. I was there. People came from all over the country. Over 1,000 people came. No national figures came from among the Democratic establishment. They were not there. Also, none of the leaders of the so-called pro-choice movement were there. Now wasn't there as a national representative. The leader of NARAL wasn't there. Nobody from the national leadership of Feminist Majority was there. These forces, they've distanced themselves from the procedure and from those who provide it, including when they're under deadly assault. And we actually have to get out of, you know, anybody who is, their allegiance is more to the Democrats than to the fundamental rights of women has no legitimacy at this moment calling themselves a pro-choice leader. And we have to move in a different direction.
We have about 2.5 minutes here. Let me raise this. Throughout your writings, and even what you're pointing to now, this question of morality looms large. And a morality, a bigger morality, a morality linked to the emancipation of humanity. And part of that, a critical part of that is the emancipation of women. Can you speak to that morality? What is it that we're faced with today? Because abortion rights, as important as they are not going to mean the liberation of women, quite frankly. But there seems to be something more. Abortion rights are a critical part of getting somewhere bigger. Can you talk to that?
Well, I think at heart, the two antagonistic views are, one is that women's fundamental role is to bear children, to be a breeder, maybe to be the property of men as a sexual object or as a helpmeet or breeder of the children. That's one view, and that's frankly been the dominant view through most of human recorded history. The idea that women are human beings is a very new idea on this planet. It's a very new, it's a fragile idea. And frankly, the communist revolutions of the 20th century have played a very big role in putting that idea, fighting for that idea to get air, and have been tremendously liberating. But that view that women are human beings, capable of full equality in every realm of human society together with men, is a new idea, and it's dangerously imperiled right now. And I think that's the larger battle being fought out over the right to abortion. There's not a single anti-abortion organization that's not also against birth control, because their view is that women should be breeders. And if you want women to be liberated, if you think that women are human beings whose destiny is not principally determined by our biological ability to bear children, then you actually have to take up the aggressive, the positive fight for women to be viewed as more than mothers, to be viewed as human beings first and secondarily, to the degree that they want to have children, just like to the degree that men want to have children. Children are wonderful. They should be a joy to society, but collective responsibility, not that of women alone. And I think these are two fundamentally antagonistic views, and there is no common ground, and it's time we stop acting like there is, and we get out there. We need to take back the moral high ground. It's a very liberating vision, having women being in control of their own reproduction as a part of contributing to changing the whole world, and not just, it's what we need. We do need to emancipate humanity, and you cannot do that with half of humanity shackled.
I want to reemphasize the point about everything we've been talking about and will be talking about through the remainder of this show is one more example and a very powerful call that the world does cry out for very radical change. And I want to let people know that if you're interested in seeing what we're talking about in terms of communist morality, or the kind of position that revolutionary communists take on women and on the oppression of women and the emancipation of women, women's liberation, you can see a piece at revcom.us called A Declaration for Women's Liberation and the Emancipation of All Humanity. A very powerful document. Sansara, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks, Michael.
Okay, talk to you again soon. Bye now. I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've been talking with Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper. She also sits on the national board of World Can't Wait. And we've been talking about the overarching question of the morality of abortion, the necessity of abortion rights. That's right. And for people to break out of the stranglehold and to take up the question of abortion and abortion rights as part of taking up the fight to emancipate women and to liberate all of humanity. We're going to take a short break and be right back with Wendy Norris. Welcome back. I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and that's In the Name of God from David Rovics. And I first played that when Dr. Tiller was killed. I think he wrote it for that. And it's a very powerful song, and I thought it'd be a great way to introduce this next segment of the show. Wendy Norris is a contributing writer to rhrealitycheck.org, and she also has an article, I think it's the fall issue of Ms. Magazine. It's The Battleground Nebraska, Extremists Turn Focus to Dr. Carhart. And it was a very interesting article in terms of an aspect of what we've been talking, the high ground. The people who are filled with the most passionate energy and resolve seem to be the people who are most passionately trying to take a very fundamental right away from a whole half of humanity. Wendy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, let's jump into your article here. What brought you to Nebraska? What focused your attention on Nebraska as sort of the heart of the battleground now?
Well, I've been following the militant anti-abortion movement for about 3 years now for RH Reality Check. And, you know, it seemed like a very good opportunity to really get an understanding of what these groups were all about. I think it's really important for people to know that there are sort of different threats within the anti-abortion movement. You know, there are the rosary types. They're peaceful. They're fairly passive. You could argue that they're very misguided. Who are just there to pray. They're not engaging patients. They're not trying to create any kind of disturbance. There are two other groups that are very fluid within themselves. There's the very aggressive folk that scream. They're there to intimidate the women, patients, and the staff. And then there are the militant groups that are really using this biblical defense mechanism that they've sort of schemed up that allows them to sort of take what they consider a justifiable homicide position in targeting physicians. So I think, you know, it's important to know the threats. You know, the aggressive people, the militant groups, these are folks that are in a league of their own. And going to Dr. Carhart's clinic at the end of August, when they were putting together a protest that quite honestly fizzled, but it was an important, I think, opportunity to really document what these folks are up to.
I had Dr. Carhart on my show back at that point, just a week before that demonstration at his clinic. And just a fascinating, really endearing guy who you listen to that guy and you actually, it gives you, talk about seizing the moral high ground, and it really fills you with a lot of hope. But at the same time, I'm, you know, reading your article, knowing what I know, and listening to what you just said about this, you know, can you give people a sense of who are these forces that came, that have focused on there? I mean, specifically, there's, you know, one of the things that you bring out in your article is the pivotal role that Operation Rescue seems to be playing in focusing on Dr. Carhart and his clinic.
Absolutely. Operation Rescue is definitely a key player in this movement. And again, one that has a very fluid relationship with the folks that are physically targeting physicians and clinic staff. They actually, Operation Rescue as it exists now, there are three splinter groups, and it's difficult because sometimes you do need a scorecard to keep track of all of these folks. The Operation Rescue group that is targeting Dr. Carhart presently is actually born out of a group that was begun in San Diego. They moved out to Wichita, Kansas in 2002 specifically to target Dr. Tiller. They're making some noise now that they may be moving to Omaha in order to sort of use the same tactics of legal harassment and clinic protests against Dr. Carhart. There's some question about whether they're going to be able to pull that off. But what you have with these groups is a level of disingenuousness that I think really needs to be called out. They will talk a particular party line that they don't advocate violence, yet Cheryl Sullinger, who is a key member of Operation Rescue in Wichita, spent 2 years in prison for an attempted bombing of a San Diego clinic. She also gave information to Scott Roeder, the man who has been alleged to have murdered Dr. Tiller. She gave him information so that he would know how to track his whereabouts. Jennifer McCoy, who also spent time in prison for clinic arsons in Virginia in the 1990s, visits Scott Roeder on a regular basis. And she has very close ties with Operation Rescue. And they're now currently targeting a physician in Michigan. I'm using Jennifer's story. I met Jennifer at Dr. Carhart's clinic in August, and she's got her kids in tow, and they're screaming at people, and they're waving what they claim are ultrasounds at the patients, and they're really just there to create chaos and to intimidate the staff, to intimidate women, but they give the really militant groups, like Army of God and the Lambs of Christ, they give them cover, because you don't know whom is whom. You don't have jerseys on people to say, okay, these are the folks that are just going to pray the rosary. They're going to do their thing. They're going to go home, have lunch, and feel like they've done something today. You don't know who these folks are, and because particularly around the militant groups, they're very nomadic, the clinic staff doesn't always necessarily know who these folks are. Is this just a one-time person who's out here because this is a circus environment and they want to be a part of it, or are they here to really do reconnaissance and do surveillance on who's coming and going, taking down license plates, taking photographs of people so that they can, in fact, you know, harass them?
You know, when you mentioned the Lambs of Christ, it slapped my head around, because I realized in reading your article, that was one thing that really stuck out to me, is that this group, which is notorious for its violent tactics used against abortion providers and against the abortion rights movement. And it's really interesting and telling that this guy, what's his name, Norman Westlin, you talk about, who is very much focused on this whole thing. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. And the thing that's really going to be interesting with this is that Norman Westlin actually lives in Omaha. So it's going to be very interesting to see just how Operation Rescue and the Lambs of Christ start interfacing with one another, because they will. Norman tends to be very nomadic. His group is quite secretive. It's very difficult to figure out who belongs, but there is, you know, sort of an underground movement of very ultra-conservative Catholics who support them, will allow them to stay in their homes, will feed them, will give them money for travel. What's interesting is that since the article was published at RH Reality Check and Ms. Magazine, Norman was a part of a protest in Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office in November around healthcare reform. So here is a domestic terrorist sitting inside Nancy Pelosi's office with the Capitol Police not knowing anything about this man's history. I saw the footage that Operation Rescue Insurrecta Next, which is another splinter group, which is actually started by Randall Terry. He took video, and I saw the video, and my jaw just dropped. No one knew. No one reported that, you know, Norman Westlin was sitting inside the speaker's office and then proceeded to create, you know, a disturbance and then had to be physically removed from the building. People see him dressed in his clerical collar and they get stirred up that the police are manhandling an elderly priest, but they don't know necessarily that his background is quite militant and quite aggressive.
I want to remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. Today we're talking with Wendy Norris. She's a writer for rhrealitycheck.org, and she also has an article in the fall issue of Ms. Magazine about how the battleground around abortion has shifted to Nebraska and the clinic of Dr. Leroy Carhart. You know, there's another thing that comes into play here, too, which I thought was very interesting, and that a lot of these groups that you're talking about, one, people should understand that these are not just sort of isolated morons out there, that even the role of the Catholic Church in the passage of the Stupak-Pitts Amendment in the House was really stunning. And actually, if any other religion had done that, I think it would have been all kinds of violations of tax laws and all this other, you know, where's the tax exemption status for the Catholic Church that's determining what Congress is going to do in relation to abortion rights and health care? Even more than that, there's this whole question about these are people who have done the most violent and heinous acts against abortion providers, against clinics, against women going in, all of these things. And they couch it in morality. And at the same time, you have these people, these government officials. You know, when you look at Stupak, This is a cat who lives in the C Street house, that Christian wacko place the family runs. Okay, and their goal was to have a society led by God. You know, Jesus plus nothing is their theme. And this is the guy who raised this up as the amendment, and that was passed. And it actually is a very big deal in relation to women's right to abortion, as we were just talking with Sansara Taylor about. But there's also, even in Nebraska and all these other places, there's a lot of sort of working together. And even if it just seems coincidental, there's actually a crossover between what's going on with various state authorities and what's going on with these fundamentalist wackos. And I'm thinking in particular of the attorney general in Nebraska is doing quite a job creating the atmosphere for these groups to function in full force.
Absolutely, and it goes back to this issue of knowing the threat. You know, to your point about the religious involvement in the anti-abortion movement, and particularly the militant movement, you know, these are Christian authoritarians. You don't see ultra-Orthodox Jews. You don't see fundamentalist Muslims at clinic protests. This is a distinctly Christian authoritarian, very dogmatic movement. And, you know, but they're also, you know, as you mentioned, regular people. They're not holed up in caves. They have jobs. They have families. They go to picnics. They might live next door to you, and you would have no idea that this person is plotting to throw butyric acid at a clinic or to stalk a clinic worker from her job and harass her or him. You know, it was very interesting in talking to the Bellevue Police Department, whom I spent quite a bit of time with when I was in Nebraska. They've done, I think, a really stellar job of understanding the threat. They've learned a lot from the Wichita Police Department and the circus of legal charges that were levied against Dr. Tiller over many, many years. You know, what's unfortunate is that John Bruning, the Attorney General of Nebraska, has really signaled his support for these types of harassing lawsuits. He's a very politically ambitious man, a very conservative Republican, and sees, unfortunately, like many in the state of Kansas did, that this is a step up for him in moving into the halls of political power. And I think it's important for folks to know that if these activities are going on in their communities, to know what their police departments are willing to do to protect peace and law and order. I think the Bellevue Police Department has really created a very good roadmap for other law enforcement professionals. They had 10 different agencies, federal, state, and local, involved in trying to plan for this August protest. They did a lot of work in trying to understand the FACE Act, which is federal legislation which has been used very successfully during the Clinton administration to prosecute people who were creating clinic blockades, were harassing staff and physicians. Not surprisingly, those prosecutions under the FACE Act definitely were not a priority of the Bush administration. And I think that that has emboldened a lot of these folks in thinking that they can get away with things. But at the end of the day, these law enforcement actions are really taking place at the local level. So it is important to know and to at least, you know, help your local law enforcement to understand that there are federal tools that they can use to make sure that clinics are being protected.
Well, one thing I would have to caution actually, too, is, I mean, look, first of all, I've seen many clinic defense actions where the police basically end up facilitating. They end up facilitating the abortion protesters, you know, the people that are trying to shut the clinics down. And actually, even it's very interesting to me because we're talking about the lead police authority in Nebraska is actually making, and you quote him saying, "I'm disgusted and I'm saddened and I hate it that he's," referring to Dr. Carhart, "here in Nebraska, and I hate it that he's in America." I mean, this guy is one sick individual. Now, you think about that in terms of the climate that's being unleashed and the message that's being sent to police. Stu Pack himself is a former state trooper. There's a whole apparatus that's actually moving into play here, I think, is very important to consider because, you know, even as Dr. Carhart has said, you know, you look at the kind of life that he has to live. Did you write about this where he can't go out to dinner for more than 30 minutes at a time? He has to go out in unscheduled stops. And Dr. Tiller, who these people work in places that are bunkers with no windows. You have to look at the sort of the confluence of interest between the overall powers that be here. Mm-hmm. And the police are actually part of that. They're part of actually enforcing that. And to me, there's a real danger in actually thinking that we can rely on them. There actually does. Clinic defense, I think, is actually a major, major. And you indicate this in your article. It was very heartening to see the anti-abortion people outnumbered dramatically by people fighting for the right to abortion and protecting the clinic. But that's nowhere near big enough these days, I don't think.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, again, the other point to know is that there are a lot of moving parts around this. There are some police departments that, in fact, have been a lot less aggressive in protecting the clinics than they should be, but there are some that are actually doing a fairly good job. And again, I think it's incumbent upon people in your local communities to force that and to make sure that the police departments understand that they are going to be watched in terms of what they're going to be able to do. You know, there's also a message that's being sent by attorneys generals and by the U.S. Attorney attorneys federally. And again, that's an area that people really need to be involved in. One of the other things that I think that's really key to all of this that folks need to understand, again, is this confluence of the protests with legislative action. And an issue that's going on right now, and particularly also in California, is around the personhood amendment. And basically, this is a state movement to amend constitutions to define fertilized eggs as persons with civil rights. They're using this approach in order to basically not only ban abortion, but also to ban certain types of contraception, in vitro fertilization, and embryo stem cell research. And again, there's a lot of fluidity between these movements. The militant groups are supporting this personhood stuff. I've been able to document in other articles that I've done for RH Reality Check that there are emissaries, there are people who flow between these groups, helping them out. And it's important to know that the person who is behind the personhood movement was a former employee of Operation Rescue.
Ah.
The gentleman in Oakland, Walter Hoy, who's behind the personhood movement in California, has been arrested multiple times for clinic blockades. It's all part and parcel of one movement.
All right, Wendy, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Okay. Talk to you again. I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. And we've been talking with Wendy Norris, who's a writer for rhrealitycheck.org. She has an article on the focus of the abortion battle today in Nebraska at Dr. Carhart's clinic. And we're going to take a quick break and be right back with Lindsay Horvath.
Has come and the land it is dark and the moon is the only light that we'll see. No, I won't be afraid. No, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me.
Welcome back. That was Aaron Neville with his version of Stand By Me, a very beautiful, beautiful cover of that very beautiful song. And I thought it would be important to talk about that song today, to listen to that song, because we've got to think about what, you know, the song is saying, Stand By Me. And I think it's actually, when you think of the things that we've talked about in the first part of the show, then the question comes up, what are you going to do about it? And the idea of standing by women, standing with women, standing up against the dark age morality that's being imposed on us now, standing up against the attempt to slam down the patriarchy even further. Joining us now to talk with us about the condition of abortion rights in America today is Lindsay Horvath. Lindsay's a city council member from West Hollywood and a former president of Hollywood Now. Lindsay, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Well, let's get into this. What can you tell us about, you know, people are saying, okay, is it really that bad? Are abortion rights really that much under assault? Isn't it just a clinic here, a clinic there? Yes, there's this amendment, but really on the ground, things are okay.
Actually, that's not the case. We know that over 17 states provide financial assistance to poor women seeking abortions, but 14 of them do so under court order. Over 87% of the U.S. counties do not even have services, though 34% of all women ages 15 to 44 live in those counties. We're talking about women who are of reproductive abilities in 87% of U.S. counties who cannot get these services should they find themselves in a situation where they have an unplanned pregnancy. Over 31% of U.S. metropolitan areas have no providers, and 8 of 10 residency programs don't require doctors to learn abortion procedures. So not only are we talking about the lack of services present, but also in the future, we're not training people to be able to continue to provide these services. So we're really in a very, very bad situation.
You know, it's amazing when you run down these figures like that, because you're thinking, these are things that people just don't know. I mean, I know I was amazed to hear the thing about 87% of the counties not having an abortion provider, but the things you're just running out, even including this thing about the financial aid and 14 having to do it under court orders. And again, the thing about not teaching student doctors abortion right. procedures. This is a horror because there are actually a limited number of abortion providers. And in particular, if you think of late-term abortion providers, there's a tiny handful. And what happens when those doctors are no longer here?
Exactly. And when you look at what's more, 50% of chief residents have no clinical experience or training for a life-saving abortion. So when we always hear this language that, oh, you know, in case of protecting the life of the mother, 50% of chief residents don't even get that training anyway. So how much do we really care about women, and how much do we really care about that percentage of women who use abortion as a life-saving procedure? We don't care. We're not training people to provide these services.
Now, Lindsay, you've been involved. You're a past president of Hollywood Now?
That's right. I'm the outgoing president. It's mm-hmm. nice to be 27 and be a president emeritus.
Oh. Wow, now I feel so old.
Oh, no, no.
Anyway, and I'm only, 28.
Oh, good.
Yeah, we're
very close.
Right, yeah, I wish. Anyway, let's jump in this a little bit because, one of the things that happens when you're detailing all these outrages around the state of abortion rights,
right?
What about the state of the people standing up against that? Because to me, I mean, you look at that, you look at something like, I don't know if you listened to the earlier part of the show, but we had Sansara Taylor on, and she was talking about the fact that the moral high ground in a lot of ways has been ceded to the anti-abortion people. And that even for us right now, we don't even talk about abortion rights. We always cast things in terms of pro-choice, as if abortion is the devil's word. To me, the idea that we don't have, if you think about when Obama went to Notre Dame and gave this speech that called for common ground, finding common ground with these people, there were no people from the mainstream pro-choice movement, and which should be the pro-abortion movement, they weren't there. And where is the outrage? I mean, there was 200 people when protecting Dr. Carhart's clinic in Nebraska, but there should have been thousands, I would think. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. Well, I am actually a graduate of the University of Notre Dame, and so I was very much involved with the ongoing dialogue on campus about President Obama coming to campus, and particularly given his supposed stance on abortion. But now that we see the presence of the Stupak-Pitts Amendment, when he addressed the Joint Congress, he definitively said that abortion would not be included in this bill. And so my challenge was really, how much does he stand up for abortion rights? How much do we really need to be protesting the fact that he claims to be pro-choice when he's not even really standing up for these rights to begin with? But I think that Now has always been present in terms of clinic defense. Now has always been on the front lines protecting women's rights. And speaking to the moral high ground issue, over 50% of unwanted pregnancies are the result of failed birth control. So these abortions that we're talking about, most of the time, people are trying to prevent these pregnancies from happening in the first place. And as we know, the people who are using a religious basis or a religious background for these arguments are even opposed to birth control. So this goes way beyond simply just abortion rights. This is truly controlling the bodies of women. This is truly determining for women, not allowing them to determine for themselves what happens to their bodies, what happens with their lives, and what happens with their futures. And that, to me, is more of a moral issue.
Yeah, the patriarchy is a really sickening, sickening fact of life in this society, and frankly, in all these societies since they first formed classes, the patriarch and the subordination of women to men and to breeding, basically, to becoming breeders, is just a horrifying thing that really doesn't. People need to stand up and say no to that.
Exactly. And I would also note that while we had a Democratic president, President Clinton, between 1994 and 2000, the overall abortion rate dropped by 11%. We had a pro-choice president, and the abortion rate dropped by 11%. So I think that when we're talking about this in terms of political positions and what sort of rights we're trying to protect as progressives in the United States, when progressives are in leadership, we actually are decreasing the rate of abortion because we're providing comprehensive sex education. We're educating our especially our young people, what their options are before we get to that situation. But unfortunately, what we're also seeing is that the need for abortion for poor women has increased by 7%. And the reason for that, of course, is because they don't have access to the medical services that they need. And so when we talk about things like this supposed health insurance reform, it's still not helping these women who don't have the services provided to help protect them from getting in the situation in the first place.
All right, Lindsay, we're going to have to stop it there, but I want to, since you've given us a lot to think about, I'm going to give you something to think about too, because Clinton was actually, I would really not go anywhere near calling him pro-choice or any of these other things, because his whole thing was, let's make it legal but rare. And that, I think, is something, when we accept the idea that abortion, which is the removal of a subordinate hunk of flesh from a woman's body that is not a baby, is not a child, it's not murder to get rid of that, that those kinds of abortions should be not rare, but actually be open and available to anyone without shame, without guilt, without apology, and on demand. So
I very much appreciate that we're talking about it. It's very important.
Absolutely, Lindsay. Thank you very much. I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've been speaking with Lindsay Horvath, outgoing president of Hollywood Now and current city councilperson in the city of West Hollywood. And we've been talking about the state of abortion rights in the U.S. today. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with a commentary on Change for Women in a New Society by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. Welcome back. That was Ben Harper with his piece, I Believe in a Better Way, from his CD, Both Sides of the Gun. It's always good to be reminded that things don't have to be this way, that there is a better way, but also be reminded and keep in mind that there is no better way under this system. We got to get into a whole other way. A whole other way we could be and should be living requires a whole new society. So as I was preparing for the show and I was thinking about that, and I thought that, you know what, it'd be good to run this excerpt by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. It's an excerpt from a speech he gave a number of years back called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And the excerpt talks about what could and would change in a new and different society in terms of women. So let's get into the excerpt now.
This question is, ending the oppression of women is essential to the success of building the new society. But this whole culture is so gender oppositional and sexually objectified. What are the key steps we can take towards confronting and challenging and changing this situation? And what particular roles can we as politicized men play in leading others, other men, towards a revolutionary understanding of women and how to stand fearlessly with them? Well, that's another good and very important question. It is true, ending the oppression of women is fundamental to the whole revolutionary process and to bring into being a whole new society. And it is also true, you know, as pointed out in the question, that this culture just contributes in a thousand ways to the degradation and to the oppression of women. It's everywhere you turn and every kind of thing. I mean, you know, someone was telling me that some of the shit they have of women in the ads and all the way they use them to sell all these products is really equivalent. It's the same kind of thing as having constantly being confronted with pictures of black people eating watermelons and fried chicken. You know, it's the same kind of degradation. And we wouldn't put up with that. We don't put up with that. And we shouldn't put up with this either. So that's one very important thing. We have to call this out and make people aware of it. It's so thoroughly immersed, it's so constant, and so much everywhere in the culture that people kind of become dead to it. They don't even think about it because it's just part of what's there. And we have to make this jump out to people. That's what this person was raising when they were making this comparison. We got to make this jump out to people. What are they doing here? What is the image they're portraying? What kind of social relations does this help to reinforce? So this is one thing. Exposure, this is very important. At the same time, it's also the same kind of principle that I was just talking about in terms of what he was asking about people, you know, who in these strongholds who have all these things weighing on them. The important principle is that, like Mao said, wherever there is oppression, there is or there will be resistance. There is all kinds of resistance. People, you know, in particular women, stepping forward to fight back against these things. Partly resistance also gets developed when we do more exposure. Things that were tolerable to people or that they just figured they had to put up with become more intolerable, become things that they don't feel they have to put up with when they see them sharply exposed and put out in relationship to the whole society and how it's organized and how people are being oppressed and exploited in various ways. So exposure can actually help people say, I don't have to put up with this. Or even to say, I didn't see it that way. Both men, but also even women sometimes get worn down by this. And just get used to the fact, you know, sometimes you hear them say, well, that's just the way men are. As if somehow we have to accommodate ourselves to that. As if somehow we have to, no. So we need to be exposing this sharply, also to, in order to bring forward women to oppose these things, but especially there needs to be a struggle among men about these questions. One of the things that Marx and Engels pointed out in founding the communist movement is, a big contradiction is that even the most exploited and oppressed proletarian man can act like a bourgeois in one place, in his home and in his family. And this is a big contradiction we have. It has to be struggled out. At the same time, however, we can't lose sight of the larger picture and where this is coming from. If we make the target men instead of the system, we're going to mix up things and we're going to confuse what Mao talked about. We're going to confuse two different types of contradictions. The contradictions that are among the people, even when they're sharp, and the contradictions of a very different kind between the people and the enemy. It's the system that embodies and reinforces these relations of oppression, whatever kind we're talking about. And yes, it gets sections of the people to go along with this and to feel they have a stake in it. That's one of the things we have to struggle against and overcome. And we don't have to and shouldn't accept that, but we have to keep, once again, our eye on the prize and on the larger picture. And we have to bring people to an understanding of the all-around nature of the system as well as its nature in terms of these particular forms of oppression so that people feel that these things are intolerable. When people rise up to struggle against something is when they begin to feel that these things are intolerable. And you've seen that over and over again. Most people don't see themselves as political activists most of the time in this kind of a society. I remember hearing an interesting story about someone who said, in relation to this whole thing with Iraq, well, usually I let the politicians, and she meant the regular Democratic Party politicians, take care of things, but God, they're not doing anything. They're not opposing this war that Bush is doing, so now we got to get out ourselves and do something. That's not what I like to think about doing, but now I find myself having to do it. Why? Because they feel it's intolerable. She feels it's intolerable and that nobody else is going to do this if she doesn't step forward and be part of it. This is the way that we have to, when you bring people to an understanding that something is, first of all, as horrific as it is, and second of all, that it doesn't have to be, that's when people more feel like struggling against it. As long as people don't see how horrible it is, or even if they see it's horrible, as long as they don't understand that it could be some other way, they're not going to be as determined to jump out and struggle against it. So we have to be constantly exposing two things, the horrors of this and the fact that things don't have to be this way and that people should not put up with these things. And then once again, we have to unite with people where they step out and where they give expression to the fact that they now feel these things are intolerable and they don't want to put up with them. And then we have to have friendly, yes, but very sharp struggle among the people, and in particular with men over these questions, not to make them the enemy or the target, which is the system, but also to say, look, if we're going to get up and out of this, we have to throw off this burden that's on us. We have to throw off these ways in which the system is dragging us down in the mud. We have to throw off the ways in which it's getting one part of the people to join in the oppression of the other part of the people. One half of humanity can't be chained and humanity be free. So this is a very important thing we have to bring out very forcefully.
That was Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, from the talk Revolution, the DVD. You can access that whole speech at revolutiontalk.net. Avakian has also done some really remarkable path-breaking and development of a Marxist analysis, a communist analysis of the oppression of women, and that's available at revcom.us in a talk called Unresolved Contradictions, Driving Forces for Revolution. Well, that about wraps it up for today's show. I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. I want to thank all of my guests, Ansara Taylor, Lindsay Horvath, Wendy Norris, and all of you for tuning in. And remember, each and every week, what we try to bring in this show is the understanding that the world cries out in ways that it never before. It cries out for radical change that's both necessary and what's really promising is that it's possible today. But it all depends on what we do, what you and I and each and every one of us stand up and do to bring about that kind of change. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that address is michaelslate@redfuture.com. I look forward to hearing from you, your thoughts, ideas, criticisms, comments, whatever. Send them in and we can continue the dialogue. I want to thank my board op today, Teddy Robinson. I want to thank Age and Henry for production assistance, and all of you again for tuning in. We're going to go out with a song that's a very beautiful song that I rediscovered at the time of the murder of Dr. Tiller. It's a song from Cyndi Lauper. It's called Sally's Pigeons, a very moving song about a friend of Cindy's that was lost to a back alley abortion.
When I was 8, I had a friend with a pirate smile. Make believe and play pretend we were innocent and wild. Hop the fence and slam the gate, running down my alleyway in time to watch Sally's pigeons fly. We love to watch them dive and soar, circle in the sky, free as a bird from 3 to 4, and never knowing why. Neighbors pull their wash back in, put away my Barbie can. Look out overhead while Sally's pigeons fly. I had a fool's confidence that the world had no boundaries, but instinct and common sense, they come in different quantities. My heart began to skip to the beat of the boy next door. She had her eye across the street on someone shy and tall. We lived our dreams and challenged fate until she told. And Sally led his pigeons up to fly. Ooh. Ooh. On the dresser sits a frame with a photograph. Two little girls in ponytails some 21 years back. She left one night with just a nod, was lost from some back alley job. I close my eyes and Sally's pigeons fly.